Hi, everyone. Welcome to Through the Keyhole on Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest today is environmental activist and author Jean Eisenhower. Jean's new book, Rattlesnake Fire, is an absolute must-read for anyone who's interested not only in alien abductions or mind control, but also if you're interested in shamanism, spiritual openness, or just learning to take control of your own life. Jean describes her own experiences in this book, which includes several years of government harassment for her activism, followed by UFO sightings and memories of early abuse that might be linked to abduction, in a matter-of-fact voice that impressed me as underscoring her bravery in facing and sharing these experiences that are sometimes terrifying and sometimes absolutely wrenching. Jean found that approaching her questions about her life and her past from a shamanistic standpoint, which is not something you come across in many of the books that are out there and available, brought her a great deal of insight and strength in her quest. She's truly an inspiration to us all, and I predict that this book will remain a classic long after many others have fallen by the wayside. For more information on finding her book, visit her website at www.rattlesnakefire.net. Jean, can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Jean, thank you so much for being willing to come on the show and talk about your book and your experiences.
Well, thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, thanks. I have to say, I just finished reading your book the other day, and like the minute I put it down, I said, I have got to talk with Jean because it was just incredible. I've read several books in the UFO field. Probably a lot of listeners know that my husband is Rich Dolan, who wrote UFOs in the National Security State. So we have a lot of UFO books around and books that deal with mind control or alien abduction. But I've never really come across one like yours in which someone talks about their own experiences so intensely. You really didn't spare yourself at all, and you didn't try to dramatize things. I never felt that you were trying to write something up in a way to make it a good story. You wrote what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And said, here it is. And it was an amazing story. You never had to try to change anything or write it up.
Well, you know, I studied writing and nonfiction, and there were times where I did feel like some of these, you know, were worthy of a story. And just because I've been a writer for a while, it seemed like what I was supposed to do. But if I tried to dramatize the story, it would have been 1,000 pages long. There was so much that happened to me that I just decided to just keep it spare, just put the details in there that another person needs to, you know, might need to hear to get the big picture, but not lead you through all the drama. So I'm glad you appreciated that. I wasn't sure it would work when I published it.
Well, it certainly did, and that seemed to make it more real to me that... At first, when I first started reading, I thought, boy, this sort of feels almost as if you're hopping around from one thing to the next. But, you know, that's how life is.
Mm-hmm.
That's how things occur.
Right.
And so that made it easier to draw correlations, you know, where I've spoken with other people and they maybe have described similar incidents.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, but I don't have this whole big background to it. But then I was reading the same thing in your book and I think, oh, there's the context.
Mm-hmm. And when I was in the middle of it, it was very hard to make sense of it. I felt like my whole life was hopping around. That when I tried to get a handle on it in the beginning, I tried to draw myself little maps of, you know, where's all the potential alien aspects and put them in some order, and then try to put the government stuff in order and try to put my spiritual life in order. And I would try to draw these columns to try to make sense of it. And I needed to do that because... when these things start happening to you, it causes a lot of chaos in your mind, which is appropriate because we put together a worldview little by little, and we work to keep it comfortable, which means not shifting things around too much. And if something comes that wants to break up your worldview, you're going to have things shift and be broken up for a little while. And when you're in the midst of it, you do feel... pretty scattered and broken apart. And as I finally did get to writing this book, I was aware of the jumping around feeling for it, and I thought, well, that's okay. The reader can feel how I felt.
I felt that made it much more powerful. It seemed so much more real, because that's the way things actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the book progressed and you started making connections and drawing things together, I felt like I was there with you, seeing how you did it.
Uh-huh.
And how the thought process worked, and it was fascinating.
I'm glad. Thanks.
You know, I was really interested in one aspect of the book is that I realized it's really about reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, you know, what is the nature of reality?
Right.
We all grow up with a certain worldview that we're taught by our parents and our families and our friends and our culture, which we get mostly from TV, I think.
Right.
And we all think that that's real.
Mm-hmm.
And even some people who look at the TV ads and say, well, that's not real. What's real is my job.
Right.
And I've been thinking, well, wait a minute. You know, maybe that's not either.
Right.
And I was really impressed by the way you were able to just leave your job and go and live in New Mexico. And you described sometimes where you get up in the morning and see the sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd spend all day being in touch with what was really real.
Right. Well, that was in Arizona. It was very near New Mexico.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, I almost felt like I didn't have a choice at that point. And interestingly, I was falling apart before the memories of mind control came on and before the consciousness of alien contact came on. I was falling apart for other aspects of this world, like health insurance companies going bankrupt right when your son gets cancer and, you know, things like that. But I had started having the memories of childhood sexual abuse, and a strange memory of four government type men in a car that I'm with it as a young child. That didn't make sense, but things like that were coming back to me, and suddenly I felt like I could not cope with the busyness of the city. Everything from traffic and schedules to the backup lights on, you know, construction equipment, you know, those that beep, 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 just all the noises were just too much for me. And where most people would think that was a bad thing, I now look back and consider it a blessing. It was the sort of thing that, you know, drove me to find my center and, you know, find my spiritual core. And, yes, to go out and just day after day watch the sunrises and watch the sunsets was the biggest blessing, and I just wish everybody could do that today.
I did too. I think it's really fascinating that there was something, there was some core of you even at that point when you were living in this culture. You had a 9-to-5 job and you had the health insurance and all of this, and living in the city, and there was something, some part of you that stood up even then and said, this is not real, this is not right,
mm-hmm.
and I need to get away from it.
Yep. I knew that I needed to figure something out, and there'd been a year between knowing that my reality had some huge flaw in it, and I didn't know what it was, to that point, a whole year of wrestling, and I figured if I could focus on it for a year and not get anywhere, I just got to get away. So I did it, and I'm so happy I could.
I'm really happy that you were able to do that. I wish more people could.
Mm-hmm.
It would be, well, probably more people can than realize they can.
Right. But you've got to be willing to walk away from this culture. And again, here's a crazy irony. I feel like I was able to walk away from this culture because deep inside, even though it was buried and I wasn't conscious of what it was, I had been really harmed by this culture. And I had some part of me that was enraged by it, that knew I'd been hurt by it, that I felt no loyalty at all to the culture. Even though I was going along with it, you know, on the surface, somewhere deep inside there was some part of me that didn't want to play along. And that was why I was an environmental activist and was even willing to be an Earth First activist for a while. a very radical group of people expressing a lot of rage that I didn't even know I had at the time buried. And so I'd already known that I was willing to be a counterculture person, and that made it easy to walk away from the culture for a little while. I had a lot of romantic feelings about, you know, the hermit, mm-hmm. and the walking into the unknown. And so I guess I'd read, you know, Hermann Hesse as a child, and I think it's Narcissus and Golden. It's been decades since I read it, but, you know, one of them took off on a journey not knowing where they were going to go. And that had always, you know, had a lot of romance for me, so I finally got to do it when my children were both on their own. And my son, by the way, he was healed from his cancer, so he's healthy and well now.
I'm so glad to hear that. Mm-hmm. You did mention in the book that he was doing better.
Oh, he's doing wonderfully.
Oh, fantastic. I was thinking, as you were talking, about being able to break away and go off away from culture, it was almost as if, by the health insurance especially, going bankrupt, it was like the culture had sort of cut you loose.
Right.
I mean, there was nothing tying you down. It's like,
right.
You know, what am I staying here for? I don't have anything.
Yeah. Yep.
Many people have jobs and they feel like they can't walk away because, well, I have this mortgage, I have a family, I have to have the health insurance that goes with
right.
my job, I'm tied.
But when the health insurance company went bankrupt and in 2 years' time, I was $60,000 in debt.
Oh.
After 1 year, I was maybe $45,000 in debt. And I'd been a debt-free person up until that point in my life. I'd never had a credit card that ever had a balance on it over a month. Now, I never had a savings either, but I still was a debt-free person. And when I was suddenly, I'm guessing, $40,000, $45,000 in debt in 1 year's time, money meant nothing to me. But I'd been offered lots of credit cards, and so with money not real anymore, yeah, it's like freedom is, you know, nothing left to lose.
Yeah.
So I just took my freedom.
I don't think money's real to the credit card companies either.
Yeah, me neither.
Big numbers. And they
uh-huh.
when the big numbers are on their side, but that's all they think.
That's true. I think a lot of, yeah.
It's true. I mean, the numbers are so big that it doesn't seem like actual money anymore after a while. And that's why they're so insidious and why so many people get caught by that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's like playing Monopoly.
Yeah.
Strange.
I wonder if our current economic crisis goes any deeper, how many people are going to suddenly be freed to live the lives that their hearts want them to live, you know? While so many people are afraid of the economic situation, it also could be a wonderfully freeing thing, too.
So you have this wonderful way of looking at things that anyone else would think, oh my gosh, this is going to be absolutely devastating, this will be such a terrible thing, and you can always find the positive aspect of it.
Well, I think that there's positive in almost everything, which I could never have said before. But, yeah, I do think it's true. I mean,
Before all of the experiences in the book, or is there some point where you feel like you were able to begin to see that?
Oh, I think it just came on me slowly. Yeah, I've done a lot of, you know, philosophical questioning over these years, and it's just pretty much come on slowly.
I can only hope that more of us are able, even if we're not able to get off and go live in the desert in Arizona and live that wonderful life that you described, just, you know, getting up and looking at the sun, that's mm-hmm. really what we all need.
We do. It's a sacred thing. And healing thing.
Yeah, we're really able to get in touch with a lot of what people use the phrase New Age to describe now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of shamanism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you were describing this in the book, it sounded like you already understood, or you had already studied shamanism or shamanistic symbolism.
Well, I don't, what order did things come in? I think when I moved out to the land, I owned a deck of divination cards, created by Jamie Sams, a Native American woman, and I'm sorry I don't know her tribal background, But that's about all I had. I was just aware of some animal symbology. And so I think that I had just kind of played around with, you know, looking up the different animals at different times very infrequently for maybe a year and a half. And at the time that my girlfriend said to me, I think we're undergoing shamanic initiations, I had just asked her the question, well, what in the world is going on? Because I'd had a lot of anomalous experiences, and a lot of them were attended with feelings of exhilaration and great hope and expectation and wonder. And yet, I still wanted to know, what does it mean, though? You know, I feel wonderful about it, but what does it mean? And so when she said that, I wasn't familiar with the term shamanism much at all. It was just this word that meant something exotic. It shocked me for her to say such a thing. But as I say in the book, I had this moment of absolute resistance to such a concept that I would be initiated into something that I hadn't even sought out and that I didn't even know what it was about. And that moment passed very, very quickly, like split second, and I suddenly just felt like this wash of, oh, a relief. That does probably explain it. Now I just need to find out what shamanism is. And I felt like a whole lot of things in my life would be explained when I started studying shamanism. So I was fully into my hermitage by then.
Oh, that's wonderful. And that just illustrates the concept that your body knows more sometimes than your mind does.
Right, right. We don't have to go after things. And there is such a, yeah, things can be given to us in a sense.
I was talking with another friend recently, and he was saying, you know, people can tell when something is wrong with their lives because you feel it.
Right.
You feel in your body that there's a problem. You don't always know in your head what the problem is.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes we feel it in our body, and then we put it into words, and that's where we come to the understanding. And I don't mind at all using the mental faculties to understand what we feel in our bodies. I think that is the purpose of the mind. But what I object to about rationality is when we use our minds to try to pull something in from somebody else's mind, from somebody else's book or whatever, unless it fully resonates with our body. And then, you know, then I think we should accept it. But I got into trouble in religion when I was young because I accepted these concepts through the rational faculty, and it never really quite felt right, but I still went along because I thought I should. So,
And that probably happens a lot to very many people, that things feel like they're not quite right, but you can't mentally or intellectually find the problem.
And you can you can mentally and intellectually talk yourself out of what your body's feeling.
Yeah, when we try to use our minds to contradict what our body is trying to tell us, and our brains keep saying, no, everything's fine. Well, no,
right.
It's not, a lot of times.
Right. Yeah, that was, I feel like that's one of the biggest, most important changes that I went through when my whole worldview was rearranged, was that I finally was able to listen to what my body, my heart were saying, and quit obeying so much these rational constructs when they just didn't resonate with me.
That had to be very difficult, though. You described your early days being married to a man who became a minister.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, there's a culture right there where the woman is, I mean, it's bad enough. Women are second place in many situations. And then when you're married to a minister, you get into the religious culture. You get even more of this, women are subjugated to men. And I don't want to start sounding like, oh, we're going to turn this into a political feminist discussion. But it's true.
It is true.
That really almost every religion does see women are supposed to do what their menfolk tell them to.
Mm-hmm.
And especially as a minister's wife, you're really supposed to do what the menfolk tell you.
Right. And things are a whole lot better now, but back in the 70s, it was pretty bad. I was never asked whether I liked the idea of playing the role of the minister's wife. It just was handed to me, and no questions were asked. And I didn't do very well. I happened to be have very young children at the time. So, excuse me, after church, the church that we were ministering in was 75 miles away from home, and so after church we would go to somebody's house every Sunday for lunch, and afterwards, after lunch, the kids were young enough to take a nap. Well, I always napped with them in order to escape all of the face-to-face personal time with people, because I did not feel like I was my real self, and it was exhausting to go through the motions of pretending to converse with people when I wasn't even real. So I'm glad that period of my life's over.
Wow. I can't imagine. I would have been terrible at a situation like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was terrible. I slept through as much of it as I could.
Oh, gosh. Because I can't really imagine what it must have been like, even at the most basic level, being married to someone who would make a career decision like that that would affect the whole family in such a strong way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really would change your entire life.
Right.
In so many ways that probably neither of you realized at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And not even discussed it with you first.
Right.
That just amazes me.
Well, I'm sure it happens a lot.
It probably does. I know. Oh, my gosh. Now, you had gone, were you working with Earth First before that, or did you get into it afterward? Or
I'm
trying to imagine this environmental activist person as a minister's wife.
Right. Well, after he quit the church and then wanted to go to seminary to study more, during this time, I became a peace activist within the Christian church. And a lot of people know that there is a very radical activist arm of Christianity that I've got a tremendous respect for. And I was so fortunate as to find a few of those churches and find some connections within them, and I became a peace activist at that time. And then after my minister husband and I divorced, and I was remarried quite a few years later, then my second husband and I connected up with Earth First. And
so you weren't officially with Earth First at that time, but...
Well, there's really nothing official to Earth First.
Oh, okay. That's how much I know about it.
Yeah. So we just started, you know, having meetings, and then they needed a bigger space, and the meetings ended up in our house, And at that time, I'd already been a reporter for a while, and then because I needed more of a 9-to-5 job, I took a job in public relations, quit that, and started my own PR firm, and I focused on helping nonprofit organizations such as environmental groups, neighborhood groups, domestic violence shelters, all sorts of, you know, anybody who was helping make the world a better place, those are my clients. And I knew that lots of them didn't have very much budget, and so I just worked for whatever they could afford and was quite content with that. And so when we hooked up with Earth First, I just started doing Earth First's PR work for free. And that was a role I played within the organization for a long time, just knowing that lots of people were doing really radical things, and I just didn't want to know about it, but I would write the press releases that would explain the purpose for our objections to whatever it was. So that was late 80s for me, whereas
okay.
The ministerial stuff was late 70s.
Okay. So two exceedingly different decades.
Yes.
Wow. We went from one end of the spectrum to the other.
I know.
I wonder whether that kind of helped prepare you where you had gone really from one end of the spectrum to another, if that helped you to feel like, okay, I've done it, now I can cut that off and I can go out in the desert and just be away from it all for a bit.
Probably. It probably did, you know. I learned in that that there's many ways to live your life. and that I could feel comfortable in different, not maybe not necessarily comfortable, but that I could, there were many possibilities for how to live a life. And Earth Firsters, there were quite a few people who were living in teepees and yurts and storage sheds. You know, I mean, that's not everybody in Earth First. There's also academics and the whole range of people. But there definitely were very marginal types of people who were happy. They were happy to be isolated from the culture and cut off and more free. So, yeah, they did set a good example for me.
Wow, it's just amazing. I love the idea of living that way, really. And I'm one of these people who kind of feels like I'm tied to culture, and you know, I have a family, and it would be hard to get away. But I would love to have the kind of life where you could just be in this meditative state whenever, and just be,
right,
and get a real sense of what is truly real. About life. What is reality?
Right. And the irony is today that not everybody really can do it. We would destroy wilderness if everybody tried to go do that.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's just literally not enough land. We have to have our cities. So I just think people just need to use wilderness a little bit more than we're used to doing. Mm-hmm. To get out and literally lie on the earth and be silent for a while. That's my favorite therapy.
And it sounds like it was very helpful. It really opened you up a lot to being able to understand and to recover some of these early memories, which were not always pleasurable or seemed like good things at the time, but you still managed to find the lesson in all of them.
Yeah, so that's true. And the flip side of it was that I wasn't chasing dollars anymore because I didn't have all the utilities to pay for and the mortgage and all the entertainment that we go after in the city, the wardrobe that we need to keep up in the city. To let go of all those expenses was incredibly freeing, too. So it was what I gained and also what I left behind. Both of them served.
I'm just looking over some notes that I had jotted down while I was reading the book. I did want to ask about when you first started... you talked about mind control. I'm sorry, I'm trying to pull my thoughts together here. And the first time you mentioned it in the book was in 2002 when you were working on a trial for a fellow member of Earth First.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your first experience with what might have been a government interference or government attempt at mind control?
You're talking about when I was doing the media work for the federal trial?
Yes.
You know, to this day, I don't know what that was. I assumed that it was what I called PSYOPs at the time. I was very familiar with the term PSYOPs, psychological operations, which is a documented FBI aspect of COINTELPRO, which is counterintelligence program. And it was pretty much the reason that the FBI was created back in the 19-teens to suppress activist organizations, and at that time it was the labor movement mostly. So I was familiar with psychological operations, and I assumed that that's what it was. And, you know, I could go both ways on this. I haven't done the hypnosis around this. I figured if I started doing hypnosis on all of my stuff, I'd never get my book written. I could just dig forever. And so I thought, I'm going to go with what I have right now, and I'll write another book later, but I want to get this book down. So I didn't explore some of these things. They just are what they are, and I think there's some value even to the reader to live with ambiguity and to live with not knowing and not feel like you have to nail everything down. And I've been forced to do that for a long time. So that very strange experience, I thought it was psychological operations, but 2 years later when I experienced something that physically felt the same, but read just like Whitley Strieber's account, then I started wondering, well, does the government possibly have technology to do something that mimics what the aliens do? Is the government working with the aliens? was that aliens back then? Because I didn't wake up in the morning with dread, except that maybe my rational mind was intrigued and thought that maybe I should feel dread, but my body didn't necessarily feel dread. What if those were some helping aliens, some who are working to support me in this life, who did something to me during the trial to strengthen me? I mean, I could read it either way, and one of these days I'll hypnotize myself. But for right now, it's part of the ambiguity that I think is kind of an important thing for all of us to appreciate. Because if we try to nail things down too quickly, we might miss a big chunk of truth. Right?
That's true. We're so accustomed to getting stories on TV. We
mm-hmm.
watch a 30-minute program, and we're getting actually 20 minutes of
right.
a story. And
uh-huh.
we have to introduce all the characters and introduce the background and then go through the entire plot and bring it to a climax and then have a conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
20 minutes.
Right.
I mean,
and at the end,
and
we
bing,
know
bing, bing, bing,
what
bing.
Happened, and we're satisfied.
Exactly. We turn off our TV, or actually we don't. We go to the next program,
mm-hmm.
and we do it again.
Right.
And then wonder why we have no attention span.
Right.
And we don't learn anything.
Uh-huh.
Because it's just a quick little story getting thrown at us.
And, uh-huh. And it yeah. might be that we don't, you know, at the time that we're faced with the problem, we might not have the context to be able to understand, even if somebody would give us the answer
mm-hmm.
in language that we could understand, we still might misunderstand it because we don't yet have the context.
Right.
And so sometimes we might do better in our lives arriving at our own truth if we spend some time just being with the ambiguity. And so I serve that to the readers. There's a few things where I think I'm safe making a conclusion, and, you know, you find them in there.
Uh-huh.
And yet I'll still sometimes introduce a question like, this is what I think it is, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
shrug my shoulders, I don't know.
That ambiguity was really important. We need to learn to accept ambiguity,
mm-hmm.
as you said. I mean, sometimes that's what there is. And maybe we can understand more, and maybe we can't, and maybe it just isn't time yet.
Right. And I think that accepting ambiguity is what can help us to perceive a larger worldview. Because if we're going to try to understand something in our current worldview, we're probably just going to we're going to keep that same worldview. I think I'm not doing too well explaining myself here.
Well, sometimes maybe something that we're experiencing is important to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's more important to someone else than it is to us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there might be times, for example, when I look at my life, I might see things that don't seem to make sense to me, but maybe that's because they don't. Maybe I needed
mm-hmm.
to do that for someone else's benefit.
Uh-huh.
And I might not even know what good it did another person.
And you might never know.
Exactly,
and that's okay.
And that doesn't matter.
Right.
I don't need to know.
Right. Right.
But it's hard to come to grips with that because
uh-huh.
we're brought up with this concept of, I got my 20-minute story, and I want my introduction, I want my plot, my climax, my
mm-hmm.
conclusion,
mm-hmm.
and I want to know what happened.
Right. And all this isn't to say that we shouldn't be wondering. I think
mm-hmm.
it's right to always hold these questions, you know, lightly, not like we're going to try to wring the answer out of them. But don't forget about them either. Don't throw them away.
Because then you might miss the answer when it does come by.
Right, right. So I enjoy working with these things. And some of the questions that I didn't know 4 years ago, I have come across answers that I feel I feel satisfied to have made some philosophical progress in my life. To have expanded a worldview that makes a little bit more sense to me now and has more parts that I feel like I can actually negotiate and work with. But there's no rushing it. It doesn't seem like it's something that can be rushed. And yet, I guess it's there's this double dynamic. You can't rush it, but you also need to continue to work with it. You can't be lazy either.
Mm-hmm. You need to stay with it,
mm-hmm.
but not try to force it.
Right.
And that, again, I was going to mention a minute ago, and this sounds like the same type of thing. It sounds like a very Buddhist point of view, that you accept, you look at what's there, and you accept it for what it is, and then let go.
Right.
Let it do what it's going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I like bringing in these Buddhist concepts and Christian concepts and other spiritual concepts. I find the more I read in the various religions, the more truth I'm finding, and the more deep and wonderful the world becomes.
It's nice to hear someone talking about various religions in a way that sounds like there are positive lessons. The fashion right now is to talk about organized religion as in terms of all of the ways they've been subverted and that they're used to control people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. A lot of them have been subverted. They're not, the forms that we see today are not the original forms.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people, there are always people who want power over others, and they will always rise to the top of an organization because
mm-hmm.
they're the ones who will try to do that.
Right.
You know, people who enjoy power are the ones who take the positions at the top, which somebody needs to do, and most of us are happy to let them do it. But a lot of times it turns out they're the last people who should have that kind of power over other people.
Mm-hmm. That's true. But yeah. there's been plenty of bashing of religions, and I've heard it, and I've participated in it, and I think a lot of it's true, like you say. But there's so much wisdom there, too. And so we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. But I don't really go to religion looking for, or to any particular scriptures looking for help, but it's there everywhere in our culture. You know, you can't pick up a book without somebody, well, not always, but you do come across scriptures quoted here and there. It's just, you know, throughout our culture. And I enjoy it when I come across something and I go, oh, that is so absolutely true. And it touches my life in this way. And you saw I've dropped those scriptures here and there through
mm-hmm.
my book, and they've given me a lot of confidence that as I'm forging a new worldview for myself, that I'm not going off on the deep end or wandering into some quagmire or wilderness. Where I find myself is where the prophets of old and wise people from all every different religion have arrived. So it gives me confidence and hope that my conclusions are they've got some support with some other good minds anyway.
Mm-hmm. And when you get down to the basics of religious teachings from nearly any religion,
mm-hmm.
you do find these spiritual truths,
mm-hmm.
these same underlying truths
mm-hmm.
that are not confined to any one religion.
Right.
That's the thing that bothers me most about organized religion nowadays, and especially when people talk about it, there's this us versus them attitude.
Right.
About a lot.
And that's so contrary.
It's so contrary,
ironic. I wish they could see it.
Usually of the religion they're defending.
I know.
People look. You know, look at the book.
Right.
Yeah,
but everybody's on their own path, and we're not going to get them to look if they don't want to look.
Right. And, you know, their path maybe is to get us thinking about these things.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it weren't for people saying things that make me uncomfortable, I wouldn't be examining my own feelings about why. What is it that bothers me about that when I hear someone say that?
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe it cycles back. Maybe then they're able to debate with people or to discuss with people something that'll make them think
mm-hmm.
and re-examine. And we all go through stages, too. It's too easy when we're conversing with someone to say, oh, that's a person who believes such and such.
Right.
But 1 year later or 5 years later or 10 years later, they could be completely turned around on certain points.
Mm-hmm. But one of the most interesting aspects of the religious question, especially for those of us living in the United States, with this quote-unquote separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm. I like the quote-unquote.
That we are being trained to have two minds. That we have our religious and spiritual ideas, and then we're told to put those aside, and then we talk about economy and law and government, and they're not supposed to have anything to do with what we believe is morality and the right way to live. And the fact that an entire nation of people thinks that this is a good idea, I mean, I do understand that trying to govern by religious precepts is also really dangerous, but there's got to be a third way, which is a funny Buddhist term. We've got to find a third way. We can't separate it, but we also can't have scriptures driving our government, I don't think. But somehow we have to have an economy that has justice, have laws that have compassion, and allow people to do the work of integrating these. By separating them, I don't think it's mentally healthy, mm-hmm. and we end up with a government that is not just amoral, but very often immoral.
That's true. I think part of the reason why we would want to have this concept of separation in church and state is because it's dangerous to have all of our laws made
mm-hmm.
by members of any one religion.
Exactly.
You don't want to have any mm-hmm. one group making
right.
the rules that everyone else has to live by.
Right.
Because
so
inevitably there will be clashes with someone else's religion.
Right. And so I'm not advocating that. I don't want to be misunderstood
right.
there.
Oh, right. But I can see where that came from. And that does mm-hmm. sound reasonable when you think of it that way.
Uh-huh.
However,
It was a worthy experiment, is how
right.
I think of it.
But we need to accept the fact that it failed.
Right, right. And now let's start grappling with how to bring mm-hmm. senses of morality and ethics into law and economy.
Right, and it is true that now we have a society full of people who maybe have laws, but our spiritual side is left untended.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because even with a lot of religions, a lot of people are... they want to be very spiritual. They do go to church. But then even there, what it seemed to me when I stopped going to church, it seemed to me that there's this attitude that if you go to this building for 1 hour every Sunday, then everything's fine.
Right. That sort of simplicity is so ridiculous.
And so many people don't seem to feel that they need to be nice people for the rest of the week.
Uh-huh. That's correct.
Well, you know, you don't just do it for 1 hour a week. You have to be nice all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yep.
you know, if you want to go to church and talk about how it's wrong to steal,
uh-huh.
then you can't go back to work on Monday and do a job that involves stealing
right.
from another company. Or, and seriously, I mean, when you think about it, that's what a lot of companies do.
Mm-hmm. They
okay,
do.
And I'm not trying to get into details and accuse anybody of anything, but seriously, big businesses and some small businesses, if they want to be big,
mm-hmm.
that's what you have to do.
Right. And then to bring it just down to the individual again, if a person's given too simplistic of a, you know, ticket to heaven, they have been robbed of their personal challenge to discover their own spiritual life and their own spiritual connectedness, their spiritual perceptions, their spiritual decision-making. They just had that that ticket gave,
yeah.
just took the job away from them,
right.
which I consider is the whole point of life. And that's a huge loss for millions and millions of individuals to sustain.
It is, and I think we're seeing a society now of people who are dealing with the effects of that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is what happens when you
mm-hmm.
take away the chance for people to think and work toward their own spiritual development.
Right.
You know, what else do? We go to our jobs and we come home and watch TV.
Right. And we so often say, what's going on? Well, you know, that's the answer.
Yeah. But too often we say, what's going on with Britney Spears this week?
Oh, my goodness.
What are Brad and Angelina up to? Who cares?
No, I am so sad that is actually important to anybody.
It is. Well, but the reason it is every place we go, there it is.
Mm-hmm.
And why is this the message that's being put out? Is this being put out here deliberately?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are we being kept down? Is someone in power? And a lot of people think, yes, this is exactly what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Who's making the decisions?
Right.
That every form of the media is going to cover Britney Spears and Angelina.
Yeah, and waste all that paper and all that airtime. And that airtime, you know, belongs to us. It's a public resource. Waste it on that and not tell us the important things that are going on and the important decisions that are being made that we would like to have a voice in.
Right. We would like to know what's going on in the Middle East.
Right.
And
yeah.
How many American soldiers died today?
Uh-huh.
And they're not telling us that.
Yeah. And how many soldiers that are home have gotten the health care that they need.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We see an occasional program about that, and it's horrifying.
Right. Right. And yeah, there's definitely writers who have been called conspiracy theorists to state that there's something going on, that this is what we're being fed, and, you know, via television, radio, and the newspapers and magazines, when there's so much more that we need to know.
And I love that term, conspiracy theorist.
I do, too.
I mean, you know, it comes right out, and it's like a way of saying, well, you're nuts. You're a conspiracy theorist, therefore,
mm-hmm.
That's a nice way of saying you're crazy.
But
nobody should listen to anything you say.
But when we think about those two words, it's fascinating.
Yeah, conspiracy just means more than one person.
And that's exactly what humans always do. We are tribal people, so conspiracy is what happens everywhere all the time.
Exactly. And when you look at a TV and you flip all the channels and they're all showing the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's a conspiracy because they all had to agree what they were going to show.
Right. And then a theory, for them to use this word theory and theorist in a derisive way, it's basically saying don't think.
I was just
don't
thinking
develop
exactly
a theory.
Those words. It's telling us not to think.
Uh-huh.
Don't come up with a theory. Don't think about it. Just sit down and watch.
Yeah.
They'll tell you what to think.
And not only don't come up with a theory, but don't come up with a theory that is absolutely common. Conspiracy is absolutely common. It is what we are. We are conspiring people. We breathe together. We think together. We plan together. That is our world. And to say that... that, yeah, bad goes on the planet, but it's never done. It's only done by one person alone. It's never done in a group. Give me a break.
Exactly.
And so they're saying don't think about what is so totally obvious. And how the fact that they could get away with making that phrase a derogatory term and nobody questioned it all these years, decades, I'm appalled constantly at the passivity of our culture.
And so many people use the phrase,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure, without ever thinking really about what it means.
Right.
Because it's a catchphrase.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's one good thing in studying writing, is that I was not ever allowed to use catchphrases.
Mm.
And you talked about my writing style. If we used a cliche, you know, we were told to rewrite it. And so I frequently, you know, started working with phrases and saying, well, what exactly am I trying to say? And then you start thinking about the meaning of things. And that, I think it was my writing training that made me suddenly realize that conspiracy theory is a very meaningful term, and there's no reason that it should be discouraged. We should all be theorizing all the time.
I would take it as a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're usually onto something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have a theory of a conspiracy. I don't know if you want to go off topic like this, but I just have to say, talking about the phrase conspiracy theory, I really, really hate it when it's used disparagingly in reference to 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
People say, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist.
There's great evidence about
the official story is a conspiracy.
Exactly.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
the story that the government is telling us is that there was a conspiracy.
Exactly.
So how come it's only bad when I think there was a conspiracy?
Right. Yeah, if we assign it to these people, it's a conspiracy theory. If we assign it to other people, then it's something else.
Right.
It's the truth.
Yeah. And just don't look too closely. Just,
right.
It's the truth. Go watch TV.
Uh-huh. Don't look at the man behind the curtain.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my gosh. Scary, scary world that we're in these days.
Mm-hmm. Time to wake up.
Yeah. So how did you face really how scary all this is? I mean, when these things started happening.
Well, I didn't face it very well. I did get incredibly frightened. I mean, there was a long period of time, I don't know if it was 2 years or more, where almost every day I didn't really want to live. And yet I was concerned for my children. I didn't want to leave them. And I'd heard that it was psychologically damaging when a family member commits suicide or even just dies, you know. And so I didn't want to do that to them. And so I stayed alive, but, oh, I did not want to be here. I really was terrified. And I began, once you allow fear to start running through your system, it really skews your perceptions. And I began to become paranoid of everybody and everything. And so the man that I was living with at the time, well, this boyfriend that I had at this time, sort of, he lived in town, I lived in the country, and I'd see him every other week. I became paranoid of him.
What were you afraid of?
I could develop a theory that he was somehow being controlled. You know, I mean, some days I would even think he was an undercover employee of the CIA.
Did you think that he was going to harm you physically?
No, but that he would just mess with my mind and then know everything I was doing, and then with that information, plots could be made against me. And then I would talk myself out of that, but then I'd think, well, maybe he's just being a little bit controlled, different ways. And I just bounced back and forth between getting myself together and getting paranoid again for years. And ended, relationship after relationship. And maybe those relationships needed to end anyway. But in any case, they did. And I definitely had a sense of failure and fear of who to trust. And when I left Arizona and I moved here to Silver City, I still had times where I would meet new people and I would think they were a Fed. That was my word, they were a Fed. And I knew that this wasn't a good way to live, being afraid of people. And even strategically, I mean, okay, the emotional part is not healthy for you. And then even strategically, if, say, I just wanted to be concerned to keep myself from being, quote-unquote, messed with, even if you cut somebody off because you know they're a Fed, there's going to be the next person who comes into your life. You know, if the right. If the federal government was tracking me still, if I put my guard up against one, then they just send in the next, of a
right.
different flavor.
And you might turn out to have been wrong about the first one, and maybe you got rid of a friend and opened up
right.
the way for an enemy to get in.
Right.
And
so
you can start rethinking yourself into a
mm-hmm.
circle.
Right. Right. So there was some point, and I'm not sure what it was. Maybe we'll remember it, and it's even in my book, and I'm forgetting it right now. There was some point at which I decided that, well, Jesus said love your enemy. Others say keep your enemy close to your chest. I decided that I could live with whomever. Oh, I know. There was some point at which I realized that it's not all black and white. People are not feds or not feds. They're not either feds or not feds.
They're not good guys and bad guys.
Right. And what if I had programming in me still that I did not undo? Then there's a possibility that I could have an aspect of me who was AFED. Mm-hmm. That blew my mind.
Wow.
And that might have been, too, the beginning of my healing, because I thought there could be somebody who could be acting because they're programmed, but 90% of them or 99% of them is a good person who could be a friend mm-hmm. and be a supporter, and maybe they've got programming in them to get a piece of information out of me. And so, therefore, I just suddenly decided to let the whole thing go. No need to try to determine who's a Fed and who's not a Fed anymore. The world is a lot of gray. You know, there's the yin-yang, and I started finding all these religious symbols. You know, the yin-yang and the loving your enemy. And just started working with that. And I don't know if I can tell you all the different ways in which this concept moved through me and released the stress, released the fear, and I even developed a theory. And I know that people change, and when there's a revolution on this planet, just a simple political revolution, there's always people on one side who go to the other side. And it's often the dominant oppressive aspect of the culture. Just before it crashes, there are people within that that power structure who never really wanted to be there.
Oh,
and they are going to be part of what helps the thing come down and helps the whole new transformation process keep rolling along.
Mm.
And so I thought, somebody could be a Fed, and they could be part of the transformation because they're going to, when the time is right, when it's time for, you know, this wheel to turn, that they're going to turn, that they're actually going to be part of the heroic change, even though right now I would label them a Fed. So I'm not calling anybody a Fed anymore. Everybody has potential for good. Everybody has potential for bad. And fear serves nothing. And
on that note, we need to take a break.
Okay.
I've been getting these little nudges from a producer, but I didn't want to interrupt you. We were right in the middle of something really good.
That's okay. That's great.
Great. I've been jotting down some notes that I want to ask you some things when we come back about what we were just talking about. But for right now, we are going to take a few minutes break. Everyone who is with us now, people who came in after the show started, this is Through the Keyhole and Paranormal Radio Network. We are going to take a few minutes break. When we return, I'll be talking some more with Jean Eisenhower about her personal experiences as described in her book, Rattlesnake Fire. It's an amazing book, and I highly recommend that you get hold of it right now and read it. She's incredible. We'll see you in a few minutes. Hi, everyone. We're back, and you're listening to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest today is environmental activist and author Jean Eisenhower. We're discussing her book today, Rattlesnake Fire, which I highly recommend. If you haven't read this yet, go out right now. Actually, wait till the show's done. Then go out, grab a copy of the book, and read it. It is phenomenal. It is one of the best-written books that I have ever read in this field.
Wow.
Jean, we were...
Thank you, Karen.
I wasn't trying to embarrass you. I'm sorry. I just really think it was wonderful. I really, really enjoyed it. And now you are going to be at the X Conference in a couple of weeks.
Yes, I am.
True? And mm-hmm. you will have your books there?
Yes, I will.
All right. So now I've been telling everybody, on the last show I interviewed Steve Bassett, and we talked about the X Conference coming up, and I was saying you have to come to the conference.
Mm-hmm.
So now here's another reason to come and meet Jean and to get a copy of her book.
Thanks.
Because it's incredible. Before we went to break, we were talking about some of your experiences with government harassment and beginning to feel like you didn't know who are the good guys and who are the bad guys.
And then deciding that it wasn't a question to be answered.
Right.
That everything's gray and everything has a potential to change.
And you talked about this remembering the concept of love your enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And this comes back into one of the things that most impressed me about your book, was that no matter what happened, you are always able to find an upside to it. You can always find the lesson.
Well, I try.
And, well, see, that's, many of us try, and you really impressed me as being able to do it.
Well, it, you know, maybe it is if you are, if you have the good fortune to be able to take the sort of time that I took, so that I could literally wallow long enough in my grief and pain, mm-hmm. that you have to come to some solution. Whereas most people are busy with their lives, their families, their jobs, and they don't have enough time to wrestle with these huge questions.
Mm-hmm.
So there it is again. Something bad actually had a good outcome.
Now, when you felt that, that someone was interfering with you,
mm-hmm.
did you believe that it was government or that it was aliens or possibly both?
Well, for most of the, you know, those years, between the 80s, late 80s, when I got involved with Earth First, through the trial, I moved away from Earth First when Judy Berry was bombed. That was just a very scary event to have been close to.
No,
and so
for,
I stayed.
For the benefit of mm-hmm. people who have not read the book yet and who might not know what we're talking about.
Okay.
Could
Shall
you just
I give
explain
a quick...
briefly, yeah, just
okay.
who Judy Berry was and what the trial was all about?
Okay. Judy Berry was an activist in Northern California who was doing just phenomenal organizing. She planned and organized Redwood Summer, which was modeled on Mississippi Summer, which had brought activists from around the world to see the racism of the South. Similar to that, Judy was bringing activists from around the world to see the last redwoods being cut down, the magnificent redwood forests. And at the very same time, she was working with a coalition of activists who were putting a referendum on the California ballot, which would have been history-making, and it seemed like it was going to pass. It would have decreed that the forestry in Northern California would from then on be based on sustainability, that they could only cut what could be also regrown, that would try to create a steady state in the forests. And it would have been a huge difference, a huge change for the timber industries. So somebody put a bomb in Judy's car, and she was then framed for that bombing. And the FBI never investigated any of the leads, but they did investigate activists. And they said that they thought Judy had had the bomb in her own car. But,
so, but she survived the bombing.
She survived the bombing, but she died 7 years later of breast cancer.
Oh.
And so the trial was Judy and Daryl, who was in the car with her, sued the FBI for not investigating the crime and basically giving a red light to people to do violence against activists, and also for the slander by calling them the bombers. And I'm embarrassed to say that I don't remember exactly what the charges were. Only four of them made it to trial, and they were found guilty on almost all charges and paid a historic settlement of $4.4 million. So I had just coincidentally made Judy my role model just 2 weeks before the bombing. And so when the bombing happened, it was a huge psychic shock to me, and I just drifted away from my activism for a lot of years. And 12 years, actually, went by. And when Daryl called and asked me if I'd like to do media work for the trial, I figured it was time to face my fears. And I went to California, and for 6 weeks, either sat in court watching the trial or else did media work, sending press releases around the country and around the world about the developments of the day. And I forget where we were.
Well, I just wanted to make sure I wasn't going to jump in and interrupt you there.
Uh-huh.
So that was a quick overview of the trial that you were involved in at the time and the role of the federal government
mm-hmm.
In the disagreement that culminated in the trial. And
right, and so the government interference in my life,
yeah,
that I was experiencing. It began with my very first beginning to be involved with Earth First, and at that time I thought it was light, and I took it all as a joke. Like they were very clearly tapping our phones, because we were, I was just doing educational work, writing postcards.
Excuse me? There was some minor interference going on, and it didn't bother you too much.
Right. They did break into our home once, and they tapped our phones. We could hear the clicking on the phones, but I just didn't take it seriously. But after Judy was bombed, and then I drifted away for 12 years and decided to come back, and I did the trial, the psyops that we talked about in the first half, that seemed like some high-tech vibrational beam that made me go unconscious, that was really alarming. And then when I got home and there was very clear evidence of my home being broken into, that was a big shock.
That had to be really frightening. And
mm-hmm.
I'm sure that was intended to be frightening, because you have to know that if they wanted to come in and just take something out of your house without you knowing about it, they'd be
mm-hmm.
able to.
Yeah, they could.
So someone clearly wanted to not only to get into your house, but to make sure that you knew they'd done it.
And they definitely left signs behind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like they would apparently get on my computer and would download the contents, because when I would then turn on my computer, it would be switched to networking, and the cursor speed would be at high speed, where I don't use it at high speed. And the electricity left on when I always turn the electricity off in my solar home, and they left lots of signs behind.
So, back to one of the earlier questions then, was, do you believe that this was the federal government doing this, or later it became a little more unclear as to whether this was aliens doing it, or whether they were involved,
right,
working together?
At that point, I don't have any reason to think it had anything to do with aliens. And when we say, was it the federal government, now I think we have to define that, because there's
yeah.
the federal government that we all think of, or most of us think of, and the federal employees who believe that they are the federal government, but there's secret layers beneath that, and then another layer beneath that, and who knows how many layers are in there. And so I think that some of the time it might have been the FBI, for what everybody thinks the FBI is, but there might have been times where it was more secret layers that, you know, were in the black budget category.
And it would have seemed at first as though perhaps you were targeted because of your work with the environmental organizations, because of your closeness to the people involved in this trial.
Mm-hmm.
And also you were working on the trial.
Right, that's what I always assumed it was.
Right, so that seems obvious. Then at that stage, that of course mm-hmm. it was because of your work on the trial. But then later, other things happened that made you think
right.
that maybe there was something deeper to it, that maybe
right.
you were chosen for a different reason.
Mm-hmm. When I got back from the trial, it was really unfortunate, because I was kind of shaken up. I was nervous. It had been a very difficult thing to be to share those hallways every single day with these men who had played some role, apparently, in hiding a would-be assassin, and to pass them, they'd make eye contact, you know. They were scary, you know. And then to go home, where I lived all by myself, it was a little, it challenged my nerves. And then to just give a little background, I've had a friend who, for a long time, she and I have had a lot in common, especially regarding our childhood, and we had a lot of similar strangeness. We both have memories of childhood sexual abuse, but there were certain aspects of it that were strange. And we would share our stories and share our memories as they came back, and share our attempts at healing. And right after the trial, she wrote me and said, "Jean, I think I have some information that might help us understand what happened to us." And so I went to the websites that she had given me, and they were all about ritual abuse or government mind control experimentation that started in the 40s and continued until the 70s, and supposedly involved children typically ages 6 and 7, and estimates were that there were as many as 20,000 children enrolled in these programs. And it was not a fun thing to feel that this all felt familiar, that it resonated, and that I felt like I was finally making sense of stuff that had never made sense before, such as that memory of being brought home by four men in the sedan with the two-tone aquamarine interior. All four of the men had shaved heads and not, you know, shaved, but like the butch of the 50s. And I remember best how I felt. I felt betrayed and enraged and pretty much out of my body with rage. And I was sitting still just trying to hold myself together. And I always wondered, looked back on that and said, what was that about? Well, when I read about MKUltra, a government-run program dealing with young children, it just started fitting. And then I read more and more and more. And every day I would uncover a new piece that perfectly fit my life. Do you want me to go into those now?
If you feel comfortable with it, sure.
Sure. Just because I think the listeners need to be convinced that mm-hmm. I just didn't, you know, grab some dramatic story and want to align myself with it, which I think is the last thing anybody would want to do.
Yeah.
There were some of the programming on, well, for one thing, I have total amnesia for ages 6 and 7, whereas I have maybe 100 memories from ages 14 months up to age 6. And then I have total blankness, and then everything comes back at age 8. So something happened to me in those 2 years. It's really strange. I read about programming of children which uses colors. And other people who've had this happen to them have testified that they were told that they were red, or they were told that they were blue, and that this was code for their programming. And I had, 8 years earlier, drawn some artwork while I was in therapy, and I was trying to make sense of my my mental situation. I'd drawn different aspects of my personality, and I'd quietly asked inside, are there any other aspects that I ought to put down here? Any other alters that I should put in this picture? And I was really dumbfounded to have a vision immediately of two children running behind one tree to behind another tree real fast, and they had no features to them. They looked like the little child versions of the international symbol for a person.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pure red and pure blue.
Wow.
And I had drawn that picture 8 years ago. I had dated it. I'd made copies of it. I gave one to my therapist, one to a friend. And all this just started resonating more and more. I read about the tortures that they wanted to use on children in order to split their minds so that they could then program the different alter parts so that a person then could switch between their alters and be amnesic for what the other alter did.
Did the red and blue, when they told the child you're red or you're blue, did that refer to the child,
mm-hmm.
the individual, or to one or two of the alters?
Oh, it probably was to the alter, spoken
okay.
to an alter.
So it was kind of like saying, we're talking to this personality now,
mm-hmm.
not the red one.
Right.
Okay.
But the way that they create alters is through torture, but they didn't want to torture the children in a way that would be visible. Because a lot of the time they were taking children from their families. And I could just imagine, this is speculation on my part, that they told parents that we're going to enroll your child in a special program that will make them very disciplined and obedient and patriotic and high-functioning, and it will improve their memory and blah, blah. You know, who knows what they would have told parents. It turned out that I was high-functioning and the most obedient child I've ever heard of. You know, I didn't ever dispute anything. And anyway, to create the alter situation, they have to do some sort of torture. And I had had a flashback to having a helmet put on my head and my jaw pushed out, and it had happened. And it was incredibly painful, and then it just ended. And I wondered, what was that all about? I had this strange memory, it felt like, of a helmet put over my head, and my jaw pushed, and I felt like I was a child. Who in the world would do anything like that to me? It was just the most bizarre thing. So this was before any of my knowledge of MKUltra had come into my life, and so I had just pushed that memory aside as just something really strange, and I don't know what to make of it. Well, now here it is, how many years later? That was in 94, and it was in 02 that I was reading about the tortures, and they talked about dislocated joints as one of the tortures that they used. Another one of the tortures was cold, and I have had a really neurotic way of nearly having panic attacks when another person would just feel like they needed to put a sweater on. But if I get cold, I can get into a state of panic. So I just read about these tortures, and I thought, oh my goodness, I guess it just keeps giving me more and more evidence, and I really wish that I didn't have to believe this.
Mm-hmm. Jean, were you from a military family?
No, I wasn't. My father was in the Navy, but he just did a small stint, but we did have other government connections. My pediatrician, when I was 6 years old, was Addison Udall, who was cousin to Stuart Udall, who was state representative of California, and in 1961 he became secretary of either state or the interior. And he lived, so Addison was my pediatrician, so he had access to me, and then Stuart Udall lived in our neighborhood, actually kind of like right behind our house, and he came to at least one of our Christmas parties just before we left California. So those were the government connections. And then one other connection that could have been my link in was that my mother is a Jack Mormon, which means kind of fallen away from the church Mormon, but we would go to church every now and then. So, and Mormons are the highest denomination within the CIA and FBI.
Really?
So they're, the Mormon CIA agents would have had access to me, but I wouldn't have been somebody that they would necessarily feel a great deal of loyalty to, since my mom was a Jack Mormon, not a good Mormon. So those were the things that made me feel like, you know, just one more little bit of possibility, but the possibilities were stacking up pretty thick.
Yeah, that's the thing. It seems like there are so many, like each individual point is so tiny.
Mm-hmm.
It's tempting to brush it off and say, oh, that could mean anything. But then there are so many of them.
And the way my body felt as I read it.
Exactly. And I meant to mention that, too. I'm so glad you brought that up, that you were describing a memory, and you said, but it felt real, and
mm-hmm.
it felt wrong. And that goes back to what we were talking about in the first hour, how your mind can be deceived or can forget, but your body does not forget these things.
Right. Right.
And wasn't there something in your book also where you said the mind can lie, but the body can't?
Uh-huh. And then I said, well, I believed that at the time I was making one decision. And then later on I decided that the body can also be trained to lie, you know, by torture. And
yeah.
But what I mean by that is, yeah, if you're tortured to not remember something, and then if you try to remember, you're going to start feeling the panic of torture. You're going to start having really bad feelings.
Yeah.
And so you might think that memory isn't real because it gives you bad feelings. Do you follow me?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it would be to the benefit of whoever is doing this and giving you these feelings,
mm-hmm.
because it makes you doubt yourself.
Right. And if you research it, that's a major part of it. When they create these programs inside children and adults who are being programmed, they need to protect, you know, they put up their firewalls, just like you do in a computer.
Yeah.
They set it up in our psyches with torture.
Right. And when they split off these altars, well, when you put an adult or a child under that kind of stress, and I imagine a child would be much more susceptible to it,
mm-hmm.
when they're under this huge amount of stress,
a coping mechanism is for the personality who's feeling that to split off from the rest,
mm-hmm.
so it can be sealed off. And they can do this several times to one person.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. I've heard of people having more than 100 alters.
Oh, my gosh.
And what that means is they just have 100 programs. But a program could be a very, very simple thing. It could be pick up the phone, or it could be go to the post office and, you know, or go meet somebody at a corner, you know, whatever. You know, I'm reaching here. This is not what I'm really familiar with at this point. But I had a memory one time that just came to me out of the blue. I was just sitting doing something else and suddenly just got this flash as if there had just been nothing but huge bright lights, and that suddenly I felt clear and new. And what I interpreted that now as was that I had created another altar in the pain of electroshock.
Oh, my God.
And some man came up, and he put his face right in my face, and he said he gave me some clear instruction, and then he backed away, and another man came with prongs, and I knew I was going to be electroshocked again. So, and then something was gone. I mean, that happened in 5 or 10 seconds. Flash, instructions, man coming with prongs, it's over.
Oh, my God.
And so that could be the memory of a single altar having been created and given a program. And these things are all stacked up and networked together just like a computer system. This is what I learned from reading. And my little bit of, and that one flashback and my gut feeling resonates with it, and I think that that is probably how they do it.
Well, it certainly sounds like it would work. I mean, it sounds like it makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
I believe that that's...
It does, and it's scary how it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's really funny. Before I ever knew any of this, as an Earth First activist, despairing over the decisions being made by Congress on everything from water quality to automobile gas mileage to everything, I was saying, why is Congress making these decisions? What sort of blackmail have they done to make them vote in favor of the corporations at every turn? What do they have on these guys? And I thought it has to be something so dirty and dark that nobody would believe it. And, of course, my brain just tried to think, what could be so dirty and dark but actually doable that nobody could speak of or talk about because it would be unbelievable and therefore it would stay hidden? And I thought they probably like blackmailed them all with like child sex or something. And come to think about it, as soon as I read about MKUltra, it turns out that these children being programmed for obedience and being tortured and being amnesiac, it was just too much of a temptation to the people in charge of this program, and pretty soon, rape was one of the tortures that was employed. And then, I believe, it also became one of the perks for the people who were doing the work, and it became a blackmail tool. And that's my own guess, but I feel really, really pretty confident about that speculation.
It really makes a lot of sense.
It does, doesn't it?
I mean, that's the horrifying thing about it, is that it's
mm-hmm.
logical.
Mm-hmm. And the RED program, which I was in, was a sex program. And when I was supposedly a virgin and was just beginning to check out my body at puberty, I was horrified that I didn't seem normal, and I think that I had been very, very well used by the time, you know, when I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I put that in this book, and I know that I'm kind of going way out there and saying some shocking stuff, but that is the case.
Well, I felt that some of the things that you did put in the book, you were really, really pushing. I was amazed that you were so brave as to put
the like the photo at the end?
Yeah.
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 Well, let's tell the listeners
really
what the photo was.
Well, even aside from that,
uh-huh.
just the emotional things that you talked about, they had to be incredibly wrenching. Mm-hmm. I mean, bad enough to go through the first time, but then to relive them and to write them and then to have to talk about them. That's why I was sort of holding back a little bit on asking about these things, because I almost feel like you've done it enough. You know,
And I don't want to tell it over and over and over again, but I don't mind if, you know, if it's enough people all hearing the story at once, you know.
Okay. So you're getting cyber hugs on the message board here.
Oh, thank you. Well, where was I going to go with this? It looks like I had been, this is my cat, if you heard the little purr or the whine over the air.
I always make a joke that when I do my show, I have a cat on my lap.
Oh, yeah, she's come and gone.
I have two cats sleeping right next to me now.
Yeah, she's my little angel here. It looked like, I had memory of being sexually tortured as a baby. And I, again, pushed that aside and said, I don't know what to make of that, and didn't think about it. It had happened to me in 93, and it wasn't until this year that I actually had the guts. I mean, you know, you talk about being brave. No, I've been terrified. It's been 15 years, well, maybe 14 because I did it last year, that it took me 14 years to have the guts to look inside me and see what was done to me. And it's really clear. I took this to my naturopath, who is a midwife. So she's looked inside many a woman, and I showed her the photograph, and she just went, oh, you know, she's almost cried over it, that I've clearly been cut. And so anyway, I just put that in the book because I figure that there's going to be an awful lot of readers who are going to want to believe that this is not true, that I somehow have imagined and put together a bunch of vague notions. But to me, it's the closest I can get to tangible evidence, and I think it's an important enough story that people need to know that this is a very dark system that's going on in the underground of our government, and that we need to have compassion for other people who think that they're remembering things, that maybe they are remembering things, and they might not have enough evidence right now, but please have compassion for them, because they could be suicidal, and they could be in their 15th year of feeling suicidal. And, you know, let's be nice to people and quit calling them hysterics and crazy and stuff, you know, because there's some very good evidence I've had on my bookcase, and I think the Fed stole it once. I used to have on my bookcase the 1971 Senate testimony of the CIA director testifying about MKUltra.
Oh, wow.
And so it's in the Senate records, and then I have a photograph of my cut insides, and then I had another really strange thing that's not directly related to this, and it might bring us back to the alien subject before the second hour is up. But it's another something that's very, very tangible, and that is that I've had heart problems for years, and of different sorts. And I could, you know, it's kind of hard to explain, but one time I went to my naturopath about my heart problem, and she started acting really strange. She took off the stethoscope, she looked out in the hallway, she came back in, she, like, moves her head around in different directions, she puts the stethoscope back on and takes it off right away, moves her head around, goes back out in the hall, she comes back, and then she looks at me with this look of great worry, and she says, "Do you hear music?" And I said, "No," but I understood what she was getting at.
Oh, wow.
And so I'd had a suspicion that I had an implant put in me or two, and I thought, well, maybe there's one in my heart, too. And so I said to her, kind of like making light of what I thought was pretty serious, I said, well, maybe it's my implant picking up a radio station. And she looked like she could have wilted because it made sense to her as a possibility. So she listened to my heart again, and then she referred me to cardiologist. And I ended up curing my heart shamanically. And that's another story that we won't go into. But I went back to her a year later, just last month, and I said, I just wanted to make sure that I really did understand this exactly right. And I relayed the story as I wrote it in the book, and she said, that's exactly right. I was hearing music in your heart. So
wow.
There's some sort of mechanic, something that has been put in there, and I don't know when or by whom. You know, it could be feds. I'd kind of like think it more likely that it would be feds with clumsy new technology rather than aliens, which we generally credit with having more advanced technology. So I don't know. But if you don't mind me going on about dealing with fear,
I have dealt with fear,
and you just deal with it. And you keep working with it, and I've written about it a lot. And I've found a few techniques, and I talk about them in my book for dealing with fear, like the shaking it off one, and writing, and praying. I've finally had to come back to prayer in my life, and philosophy. I think if you just think about the world enough, and the good and evil, that and the dark and light that seems to be in this constant mix, it can help us make peace with things and decide that rather than fear, we ought to just be making ourselves strong. You know, the lion taking down the lambs, you know, are credited with making, I don't like the lamb. Never mind.
Yeah.
Scratch the lamb metaphor. We're going to go for the deer metaphor.
Okay.
The lions going after the deer make the deer faster. You know, they're credited with making the deer a faster and a higher leaping animal. So, you know, let's do that. Let's just get faster and leap higher and turn on our perceptions and do that, because fear just doesn't serve anything.
I do just want to mention that you passed on or just touched on the subject of bravery. You said you're not very brave because you were afraid while you were doing this. Well, to my mind, being brave is being afraid of something and doing it anyway.
Yes.
Or facing it. I mean, if you're not afraid of something, then bravery doesn't come into it.
Right. Right, I agree.
The more afraid you are, the more brave you have to be to get in there and to do it and talk about it.
Right. Yeah, I heard that exact phrase, and I think it is so wise, so full of wisdom. I heard it when I was just trying to face public speaking back in the 80s.
Isn't it funny how much we can all be afraid of standing up in front of a room full of people and talking? And,
right.
And there are things like what happened to you going on in the world, and we're afraid of just standing up and talking to people.
That's pretty funny, Karen. Yeah. And so I guess at some point I just said, okay, I'm afraid, and I'll take stock and figure out what's the best step to take.
Yeah.
And suicide's out, so now what do I do? You know, I just open up my perceptions as wide as they can be. I turn on my brain, and I think, and I think, and I philosophize, and I pray, and just work with what's sent my way.
That's the most any of us can hope to do, and that should be what we spend really all of our lives trying to do.
Yep. You know, one subject that I'd love to bring up before the hour is up, if you don't have something else.
We have another about 10 minutes.
Okay. I drew an analogy toward the end of my book between the mind control efforts and the alien efforts. Do you remember that section?
I do.
I'm going to open up the book, hope I can find it.
Oh, I've got my copy right here, too, and I'm trying to remember where it is.
Okay. Now, and I'll just start with what I recall. Both of these programs were supposedly begun in childhood. Both of them seem to have begun in the 40s. Now, of course, we know that alien contact has been going back thousands of years, but there seems to be something new that began in the 40s. Both of them seem to have the intentions of creating, quote-unquote, improved humans, right? MKUltra says it's to improve humans, and some of the theories about what aliens are about is that they are trying to help us improve or in some way. In both cases, the subjects are immobilized with drugs or restraints, and they're taken against their will. Both of them try to forbid memory and amnesia results. The point said to be learning, and they both involve memories that either are or they seem like torture. And in both cases, there's often one person or entity who presents as the protector, the friend, the teacher. Now, I find this fascinating that I, you know, one day back in, I don't know when it was, 04, 05, I just suddenly realized this correspondence. And I haven't taken this anywhere to any particular conclusion or theory, unified theory of what it means, but I love just putting it out for people to think about. This is really, really interesting. And it's not a very comforting idea.
No.
It's a terrible idea.
But it is fascinating. And it does explain why there's so much confusion. When people
mm-hmm.
have memories of something happening, there is this question of, well, was it humans? Was it aliens? Is it military?
Uh-huh.
And even if you decide it's aliens, then what was their purpose?
Right.
Or what would the human's purpose be?
Uh-huh. And there have been a number of theories that this is all screen memories, that it's really all just been humans, and they create screen memories of it being aliens. And I've heard of the reverse. This is aliens, and they're creating screen memories of it being humans, military even. And then you could theorize that the government is copying a program that the aliens are doing, so that these are two separate things, and they just happen to have something in common. And then there's the theory that they could be working together. And I guess the fifth one is that they is coincidence and that they're not related in any way. But I don't know. So a lot of my book, as I said, I haven't necessarily drawn conclusions everywhere. It's one person's story, one person's perceptions with what I've thought of as an appropriately humble scientific approach, where I'm not going to draw conclusions. I don't know. I'm just going to say what the data seems to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that it contributes to the literature so that other people who might have similar stories can come forth and tell what theirs were, and eventually the researchers will have enough data that they can, that together we can all start, you know, figuring out what the patterns are here and what the meaning is and the structure behind things. But
yep.
Like you said, mine's the first, so
yeah.
I don't have the I don't have enough to draw conclusions everywhere.
But that's where to begin.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
By stepping out, by being willing to talk about your experiences, as absolutely gut-wrenching as they may be, then you're making it easier for other people to talk.
Mm-hmm.
Because the biggest argument, I think, that skeptics use is, oh, that story's outrageous, things like that don't happen.
Right.
Well, no, they do.
Yeah.
And, you know, by you coming out and talking about it, then other people can say, no, look, it happened to her, too.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or they can look at it and say, oh, my God, that sounds familiar. I
right.
think that happened to me.
Yeah.
And now they have a place to go. They have someone to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet you'll be hearing from a lot of people.
Right. And I'm not the first MK person to come out. I'm not the first alien, you know, contactee to come out. But I'm the first to come out about the two of them together in conjunction. And so I'm really grateful for those who went before me, because they took a beating, you know, in the public media, and a lot of ridicule, and
mm-hmm.
and my heart goes out to them, and I'm feeling like I'm having a much easier time. I'm really grateful for the reception that my book has gotten.
How long has your book been out, Jean?
Just since January.
Just this past January?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I just published it in January, and I didn't do any media outreach to people like you until just recently, because I, even though the book was published,
mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like I was ready to talk about it yet.
Yeah.
So I let it sit for 2 months and pretty much just told my own personal networks about it, and just very recently accepted my very first radio interview to go out to the public. And I'm really glad I did, because it's intense, and I wasn't ready to talk about it yet, but I finally am now.
Well, I was trying, you know, not to push in particular directions. I was sort of following your lead, but I am so glad that you were willing to come out and talk about this, because I do think it's incredibly important, and you have done one of the best jobs at talking about your experiences. This has to be really difficult to articulate.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
a lot of
you know, I wrote and wrote and rewrote for a long time
yeah.
before I knew I had it right.
Well, I can tell that a huge amount of work went into it, because it's just such a polished piece of work. It's a beautiful piece of writing. And
thank you.
It's so informative, and honestly, I am just struck again and again by your bravery. And a few people on the message boards are mentioning that too, and thanking you.
Mm, great. Well, I'm really grateful to all of them, and gosh, I just don't know what to say. I'm very happy. I'm glad that I spent all the years honing my writing craft, and grateful for my teachers who told me to get rid of all those clunky phrases and broke my heart over writing back then. So, yeah, it's very satisfying to have this all down and to feel that it is giving people information that they need.
Now, on that note, do you have any advice for anyone who perhaps reads your book and thinks, oh my gosh, I wonder if that happened to me? Or what would you say if someone called you up and said, I think I've had some similar experiences and I don't know what to do?
Hmm.
I don't mean to put you on the spot.
I'm kicking myself for not having had a nice, tidy answer for you. Yeah. I'll put it on my website, I promise.
Okay.
I'll put it on my website. But go into your heart, find your spiritual center, remind yourself of whatever it is that you believe in that is spiritually supportive and grounding and healing and nurturing, and know that you're protected, and no matter how horrible things are, there's a flip side to it, and there's a great amount of strength to come. So and I will answer that very important question on my website.
Okay. And Jean's website, for anyone who hasn't seen it yet, we've been posting it on the message board periodically. It's www.rattlesnakefire.net. Jean, thank you so much for being willing to come on the show. I really, really have enjoyed talking with you.
Well, I've enjoyed talking with you, Karen. I'm very grateful. Thank you.
And I look forward to seeing you next month, actually in a couple of weeks.
Right.
At the conference.
Yeah, the X conference. I hope that lots of people show up.
It should be a lot of fun. So
it will be fun. It was great last year to see everybody.
Yeah. All right. Well, it looks like that's it for this week's edition of Through the Keyhole on Paranormal Radio Network. Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us. And thank you once again, Jean, for a fantastic conversation. And thanks again for your book. I absolutely love it. And hopefully we'll do this again.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Have a great week, everybody. See you next Sunday.